people of the post-everything nightmare afterscape, it is I, Lord Mayor of the Great Rubble Field, next to the old rubble pit and north of New Rubble Mountain. I come before you now to do our nightly lesson before this lovely trash fire.
Before you begin, O Great Lord Mayor of the Afterscape, I have a question regarding message I wrote on some birchback and sent to my mother, who lives west of the land of the silent cannibals who schmooze on human food.
You're going to have to bring that up with our Director of Information Technology.
Who's that?
It's that Jack Russell Terrier sitting right over there. Now, before we begin, a moment of silence for Martin, who was killed today by the nano-wolves, and Eleanor, whose head was exploded by the Dream Extruder Wizards. That's plenty. Also, some love for John Paul, who today got us, wait for it, a functional shopping cart. Now, tonight's lesson will be a reading from a work of cyberpunk.
What is cyberpunk?
It's a kind of story from the past about a world in which computers were used to control and spy on people, and where people were alienated by rapid technological change and mechanistic invasions of their bodies.
Are computers the blunt objects which used to hum and click?
Yes.
And they worked in this shiny pastime of the cyberpunking?
Yes. No. Well, they worked, but it wasn't very good.
And the sciencing was not dead yet. It seems like a happy utopia.
Yesterday, I strangled a mutant with an old mouse cord.
Look, you people are not getting this at all. Cyberpunk was about a society where human rights were degraded because technology became too powerful.
My grandmother says there were toilets that knew when you stopped peeing and flushed themselves. A magical marvel of ancient goodness.
What's a toilet?
You know what? That's it. No story time tonight. You people just don't get it. Instead, listen to this other thing that'll explain cyberpunk. And now his new novel envisions a world in which the solar panels turn against us. Colin McEnroe.
They seem nice, those solar panels. So yes, to those poor people living in the post-apocalyptic afterscape, which is also known as year 7 of the Trump administration, cyberpunk, boy, that sounds pretty good. The computers work and everything. But in fact, cyberpunk was imagined quite differently, has been imagined quite differently since it burst onto the scene somewhere around 1980. Let me read you a little piece of cyberpunk, a little bit of prose. Over the past year or two, someone has been probing the defenses of the companies that run critical pieces of the internet. These probes take the form of precisely calibrated attacks designed to determine exactly how well these companies can defend themselves and what would be required to take them down. We don't know who is doing this, but it feels like a large nation state. China and Russia would be my first guesses. Okay, you probably figured out that's actually not cyberpunk. That was published yesterday on a site called Lawfare by one of their security columnists. And that's kind of the point, right, that cyberpunk anticipated a world much like the world that we live in, which doesn't mean that there aren't more cyberpunk stories to tell. And we have guests here today to, A, explain to you how cyberpunk came to be, what its values and its aesthetic are, and then also what stories still exist to tell within that genre, within that vein. In studio with me is Lee Grossman, who teaches at the University of Connecticut and is the author and editor of more than a dozen books, including Sense of Wonder, A Century of Science Fiction. This is a compilation sitting right next to me. It's a massive compilation of science fiction. You could work out with it. Paul DiFilippo has written more than a dozen books, including the Steampunk Trilogy and Fractal Paisleys. John Shirley has written novels in just about every genre, from horror to historical to fantasy. He's also the author of City Come A-Walkin', which is considered by some to be the first cyberpunk novel. And a little bit later, towards the end of the show, we're going to talk to one of our favorite TV critics, Willa Paskin from Slate. We're going to talk about Mr. Robot, which is winding up its second season, kind of regarded to be one of the instances of cyberpunk, the cyberpunk aesthetic, making it onto the television screen. There's lots of cyberpunk movies. We'll be talking about those too. But Lee Grossman, I'm going to have you get us started. We always have kind of a multifaceted audience. Some people are probably fairly well imbued in the world of cyberpunk and have read a lot of novels and seen the movies and can throw the term around. And for other people, it might be a completely new word. So help us out here. When we say cyberpunk, what are we saying?
Well, thanks for having me. I think we're talking about two different things. The visual aesthetic of cyberpunk, which is we've sort of gotten away from, super influential, probably best known for things like the visual of Blade Runner and hugely influential on things like anime. But But I think when we talk about cyberpunk today, we're talking a lot more about this underlying sense of, you know, world run by giant corporations, people who characters who don't have any realistic hope of victory, but are still fighting on, but aren't going to win. You know, they don't necessarily have good odds. Even the things that seem like good guys are bad guys in many cases. I think something that came out of that, you know, late 70s, you know, when I was a kid, it seemed like a revolutionary time. I was, you know, working the phone lines for the ERA. It seemed like civil rights movement was about to, you know, accomplish things. The women's rights movement, gay rights movement was just getting started. And then it all sort of came crashing down. And, you know, that not only was there this huge counter movement, but it was super well funded and super corporate. And I think there was a big response to that. And a lot of cyberpunk came out of that sense of there is no revolution within the system. There is no way to change things that we thought, control that we thought was that we were going to have, things that we thought we were going to change have all turned into talk about tax cuts.
Well, there's one place that cyberpunk reaches back to for a lot of its ethos, right? I mean, in some ways, it was the science fiction extension of what we consider to be noir detective fiction. There, it's not true in every single work of cyberpunk, but there's this idea of this lone hero, sometimes a person kind of damaged by something else that had happened to him before in this particular world, trying to right certain wrongs, trying to extract some kind of meager moral victory in a world that doesn't necessarily reward or enshrine morality. You mentioned Blade Runner. We can't give you listeners the visual aesthetic of Blade Runner that Lee Grossman mentioned, but we can remind you a little bit of the sound of it. This is Harrison Ford playing Rick Deckard, who's an investigator. He's a detective. He's a noir detective. He's trying to figure out whether a character named Rachel is an android known as a replicant in the world of Blade Runner.
You're reading a magazine. You come across a full-page nude photo of a girl.
Is this testing whether I'm a replicant or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard?
Just answer the questions, please. You're watching a stage play. A banquet is in progress. The guests are enjoying an appetizer of raw oysters. The entree consists of boiled dog.
Would you step out for a few moments, Rachel?
She's a replicant, isn't she?
I'm impressed. How many questions does it usually take to spot one?
I don't get it, Tyrell.
How many questions?
20, 30 cross-referenced.
It took more than 100 for Rachel, didn't it?
She doesn't know.
She's beginning to suspect, I think.
Suspect? How can it not know what it is?
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto. Rachel is an experiment, nothing more.
We began to recognize in them strange obsession. After all, they are emotionally inexperienced with only a few years in which to store up the experiences which you and I take for granted. If we gift them with the past, we create a cushion or pillow for their emotions, and consequently we can control them better.
Memories. You're talking about memories.
So Rick Deckard is kind of Philip Marlowe a few hundred years or however many years removed. He's this guy who, you know, he's not exactly strictly ethical, not strictly moral, but he's our set of eyes, right? Encountering all these things, including some pretty cynical rich people, which often were the stuff of Raymond Chandler novels too.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely cyberpunk is something that did reach into noir fiction and draw on a lot of noirish tropes, combining them with the aesthetics of a new computer movement, you know, the idea of, and William Gibson would joke that he invented the concept of cyberspace because he didn't like to write transition scenes. But just combining the new technology with noirish ideals and in some ways getting away, you know, using that to get away from a science fiction that was all about hopefulness and, you know, corporations can solve problems and such and into, no, this is about money.
And we're actually hearing also in that particular exchange, and that's Blade Runner, that goes back a few years, not a new idea at that time, but an idea that's more and more pressing for us. What happens when you invent an artificial intelligence, a machine, when you make a thing that can have some level of consciousness, some level of self-awareness, and in this case, a decision even to conceal from the machine that it is a machine. This is the kind of question which we're still wrestling with right now that seems to be the very stuff of cyberpunk.
Yeah, and that question wasn't new to cyberpunk, but the idea that you might want to become a machine instead of a human being to get away from your pain was certainly a new way of looking at things, as opposed to this is the next step in human evolution. It was very much about desperation, much more than hopefulness.
Producer Jonathan McNichol is pointing out to me that Blade Runner is set in 2019. That's 28 months from now, he says. All right, so yes, way, way in the future. Sorry about that. All right, let's go to our two author guests who are joining us by phone. First of all, John Shirley, William Gibson, whose name comes up over and over again, has been mentioned a few times already here, but he once called you patient zero of the cyberpunk movement. What do you think he meant by that?
Because I probably belong to all the different levels of, you know, that of the characters in cyberpunk novels embodied. I was a guy from the street to a large extent. I wasn't living on the street, but I was really close to it. And I was in punk rock bands. And at the same time, I was very, very attracted to everything in the way of like new technology that could be used by people on the street. I think it's Gibson. Was it Gibson? Maybe it was Paul here who said that cyberpunk is about the street's uses for technology.
Paul, let's ask him. Let's ask him if he said that. Paul DiFilippo, is that a quote we could ascribe to you?
Hi, Colin. A pleasure to be at this stimulating discussion today. I think John's remembering, I'd love to take credit for that quote, but I think John's remembering Bill Gibson's famous line, the street finds its uses for things, which was central to the cyberpunk aesthetic, was that technology, a lot of exciting new digital technology began at the highest levels of institutions and society, you know, DARPA, the Defense Research Organization, and IBM, and all the universities. They created and perfected this technology, and then it filtered down to the proletariat, so to speak, and you know, below even them, the punks and the outsiders. And what they did with the technology was often unpredictable and sometimes dangerous, sometimes beneficial, but it was uses that had never been envisioned by the people who invented the technology. So that was the main element of cyberpunk. How is this, you know, we have these formal official uses for things. You're only supposed to use an iPhone to, you know, for what it's intended for, but if you hack it and suddenly you're using it to set off car bombs, that's not such a good thing. And
yeah,
and
that's yet a good example.
Yeah, yet it's something that we need to examine because it's bound to happen sooner or later.
Well, I mean,
yeah, every technology has a dark side, and that is something that we bring to it too. The cyberpunk writers brought to it is that every technology has a dark side, and it has, you know, that the dark side is a shadow that you can work within to get things done that you need to do for those struggling in the underclasses, and that can be a good thing. But the dark side can also be exploited by people from Russian mafia uses hackers now, and you know, they don't care who they hurt. So this, we're having a constant, you know, struggle. It's kind of a class struggle played out in technology, there's a shifting back and forth. You know, like Sky Melnick, who was the famous hacker, has, you know, now works for big corporations exposing hackers. And so, you know, there's this movement through the system of like from the lowest classes to the highest, and then the lower classes take from the higher and use them on the street again. And it's always had that noir flavor. That's in noir too, you know, yes. But I think it's also about science fiction growing up. And really people looking around, at the uses of science and technology in an adult way, That's what it's what it really was for us. Now it's come to represent for most people a kind of anime or comic book, or and those things are cool. But originally, it had that core sense of a startled adult turning around and looking at the world that was growing up around them, which is you get from Blade Runner, which you then got in turn from Philip K. Dick. He was really the godfather of cyberpunk, Philip K. Dick.
But, you know, Paul, you know, when we talk about a dark side, I mean, it seems to me that that most cyberpunk narratives begin with a notion of something that has fallen already, right? There's this Edenic corruption that has gone on. The egg is cracked. The apple is bitten into. Whatever was going to be really good or had the option or the possibility of being a gleaming utopian delivery system of technological relief and maybe transience or transcendence, it's broken. It didn't work. It got hijacked by people with a lot of money and power and influence. So maybe I'm wrong about this,
that's an excellent point. It's in a lot of senses the cyberpunk protagonist was on kind of a redemptive course. They did see this shattered landscape, these broken dreams, and even if they were just trying to carve out a little personal niche of relief and safety for them and their friends, there was, I think, always attempt to, because that's the, you know, that's the Philip Marlowe role. He's got to right the wrongs mm-hmm. that are out there, even if it's only for one individual case, one individual murder or bribery case. He's trying to restore the balance. So I think, the cyberpunk was not on the side of the darkness by any means. It acknowledged the darkness. Sometimes that was the starting place, as you mentioned. But I do think that there were always some redemptive, there was a redemptive impulse in the literature at its best.
So, yeah, go ahead. Lee Grossman, I want to just go to you for a second. You may want to respond to what they just said. But I also I want to talk about how quickly this vision took hold, too. So, you know, I mean, whatever it was that began, it began somewhere around 1980. We can nitpick about like what the first thing ever was. But by the late 1980s, this was like a really dominant aesthetic, at least in terms of visions of the future. Try to picture what the next phase of life is going to be, and you were getting this.
Yeah, although the movie Blade Runner bombed when it first came out, for all that it became a cult hit later. I think there's an uneven development issue there. I kind of push back a little bit about, you know, cyberpunk isn't dystopian in the sense of the Hunger Games kind of thing. The whole world hasn't fallen. And in fact, to people on the inside, it is utopian in many cases. It's dystopian to the people who've been left behind, the people who have, you know, are the cyberpunk characters. In much the same way the 50s are pushed as this golden age for a lot of people, unless you were black or female or, you know, someone who wasn't on the inside, you know, and that's who the Philip Marlowe is pushing for. It's broken, but it's not broken for everybody. And it's broken in a way that you get a lot of pushback against the characters of, no, you're the one breaking it, when in fact they're the only ones fighting back against the system.
It seems
in the real world, you've got guys like Professor Steve Mann up in Toronto. You see him on the new Werner Herzog movie, Lo and Behold, and you can find him on the internet. He has a permanent device that's like bolted to his head that, you know, allows him to look at the world with more acuity, he thinks, and certainly with more technological sensitivity as he moves through it. And he's invented all these wearable devices, and he, you know, guys like him are the fulfillment to some extent of what we predicted. And he's also got this thing that fascinates me, this idea of surveillance, and this kind of applies to what you were just saying, that it's this looking from below at technology that's looking from above. So you're using technology from literally, again, from the street level, to look back at the surveillance that's going on. You're staring back at surveillance, and it's It's this constant surveillance, this, you know, cameras everywhere and facial recognition that's coming in more and more. Well, he's got devices that show you literally when these fields are turned on around you, where when you're in the field of a camera, and help you look back at the surveillers. That's kind of that's real, but it's also very symbolically something cyberpunk, right from the stories.
Yeah. No,
I use my novel Black Glass. Sorry, go on.
No. Well, I mean, in fact, there's so many ways that we could go from there, including the fact that, you know, in some ways he's like the last stronghold of the French Foreign Legion or something. I mean, there's a society that we live in that's sort of given in on a lot of that stuff. I mean, people are very comfortable, I think, for the most part, or have just latently accepted the idea that they're on camera, they're being monitored. I don't even know if there's the requisite amount of outrage from most people. But we can come back to that in a second. But one thing, Paul, I wanted to talk a little bit about too. I think another thing that cyberpunk anticipates in a really interesting way, both aesthetically and politically, is the notion that the resting state of the American hegemony is not going to last much longer. And of course, I mean, that's another reality we're probably living right now. There's this sense that the aesthetic of cyberpunk swings over, first of all, to a much more Pacific Rim look at things. And there's this kind of notion that the rest of the world isn't going to change into the United States. The United States is probably in certain ways going to have to change into the rest of the world.
Well, you know, that was very prophetic. We're seeing it. You know, we had 1989 come and go, which, as you say, you know, coincided with the real crest in the cyberpunk movement, and the real world political landscape changed incredibly. And we're living in the fallout of that now, where it's not a it's a totally multipolar world. The U.S. is arguably the last remaining superpower of its dimensions. But on the other hand, our country is finding that we cannot possibly impose our vision and our wishes on the entire rest of the globe. And that was being thought about in the early cyberpunk. You talk about the roots of cyberpunk. You can go way back to the 60s. A great humorous writer, and I think that cyberpunk doesn't get enough credit for a certain level of black humor. But a guy who was totally humorous back in the 60s. He's still around. He doesn't write quite as much as he used to. Ron Goulart, and he had a series of novels. He had a series of novels about a fragmented USA that I read as a kid and were just seminal influences on me when, even in the background of my writing, when I was thinking in cyberpunk terms. And I need to go back to them because, as I recall, the USA had fragmented into enclaves, you know, rednecks in the South and liberals in California and the West Coast and stuff, and it was very premonitory of a lot of the stuff that cyberpunk was thinking about, and maybe even a political landscape that we're looking at today. So science fiction did have, you know, there were always precursors and forerunners to these concepts, and it's fascinating to put together a lineage of this kind of stuff.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back. We've got more to say about all this, especially the way in which we maybe are kind of living in cyberpunk as opposed to reading it to get ready for what we're going to live in.
As they fall asleep, will robots dream of electric sheep? Sometimes.
All right, we're talking about cyberpunk. This is getting very interesting. Lee Grossman is here with me. He teaches at the University of Connecticut. He's the author and editor of more than a dozen books, including Sense of Wonder, A Century of Science Fiction. On the phone is Paul DeFilippo. He's written more than a dozen novels, including the Steampunk Trilogy and Fractal Paisleys. John Shirley has written novels in just about every genre, from horror to historical to fantasy. And he's the author of City Come Walkin', which is considered by some to be the first cyberpunk novel. We're going to be talking a lot in the third segment about Mr. Robot, but just to kind of set up this conversation here, let's hear a little bit of Mr. Robot's main character, Elliot, who's having a session with his therapist.
I know you have a lot to be angry about, but keeping it to yourself and staying quiet like you're doing, it's not going to help you. There's pain underneath. That's where our work needs to go. What is it about society that disappoints you so much?
Oh, I don't know. Is it that we collectively thought Steve Jobs was a great man, even when we knew he made billions off the backs of children? Or maybe it's that it feels like all our heroes are counterfeit. The world itself's just one big hoax. Spamming each other with our burning commentary masquerading as insight, our social media faking as intimacy. Or is it that we voted for this? Not with our rigged elections, but with our things, our property, our money. I'm not saying anything new. We all know why we do this, not because Hunger Games books makes us happy, but because we want to be sedated. Because it's painful not to pretend. Because we're cowards. Society.
Elliot, you're not saying anything. What's wrong?
Nothing.
All right, that's Elliot's inner soliloquy about what's really going on in society. I hear echoes of the comedian Bill Burr talking about Steve Jobs. He says, really? The old charger doesn't fit the new phone? That's your hero? Lee Grossman, this kind of feeds into something you were saying kind of during the break, which is that to a certain degree, we have absorbed the kind of dark paranoia about the stranglehold that maybe transnational corporations have over our political process. It's probably even seeping into our attitudes right here in 2016.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the resurgence of cyberpunk as an ethos. That sense of you talked about nation states in the end of the last segment, and with the latest treaties and with ISDs, there's a sense of helplessness that even the nation state is helpless. That these corporations can sue and win and force repeal of even anything nation states can do and try and make things better for people, that there's a certain helplessness against that, not just by the cyberpunk characters, but by the governments themselves.
Which, I mean, I think when you were saying, I think this is a great point, when you regard a candidacy like Hillary Clinton's where, you know, I mean, her platform is incredibly people-oriented and liberally oriented. It's really about a lot of the kinds of services that people really hope the government can provide to them. But there's some way in which people who might be expected to buy it don't buy it.
Yeah, I think partly because you read cyberpunk and the heroes expect to be betrayed. There are no good options. So even when you have someone who's running on an incredibly liberal platform and is doing all of the things that on one hand we may want, there's this expectation of she's friendly with bankers. We know how this cyberpunk story ends. We're going to be betrayed. It can't be real.
John Shirley, not that you were necessarily trying exactly to warn people, but you heard Elliot from Mr. Robot talking about how people vote with their devices, with their purchases. Matthew Kressel recently wrote, YouTube has a VR channel, virtual reality channel. Amazon.com delivers packages by drone. People wear computers on their wrists. And you've even got stuff like Fitbit. The NSA listens to every byte crossing the world. People regularly interact with AIs. I mean, in a lot of ways, cyberpunk has come true, but a lot of it's become true volitionally. We buy and use a lot of stuff that insert us into that world. Rather than being out on the streets being this rebellious hero, we've kind of gone along really happily with a lot of this stuff. Do you feel as though cyberpunk lost?
Well, it was about, you know, drama and individual drama. So it didn't really have some kind of big overarching political theme in that sense. But that was mostly a subtext. Although in my novels, A Song Called Youth, they got very political. And they were very much about sort of neo-fascism that creeps in the future. But really, it's about the struggle of the individual. But, you know, I really love that line that you just played from Mr. Robot about the how intimacy is being replaced, or people are trying to replace it with social media. And that's very true. It's something very pathetic about social media addiction. And, you know, we all indulge in it for various reasons, but we're sort of getting up to our waist in it, and it's rising, and it's coming up to our breastbones, and pretty soon it'll be up to our necks, you know. And you know, you see people on the street, they're satirized all the time, and in like political cartoons, and you see people walking around with one another but staring into their phones, and so it is unsettling, because you know those phones do in fact emanate from big companies, and just try and talk to one of those companies about your real issues with your phone. It's so hard to get through the layers into a, you know, to actually communicate with them. They act as if you can communicate with them, but you can't. And that itself is symbolic. It's like makes them very monolithic. But Paul was the guy who turned me on to this movie, Hyperreality, from Matsuda. And have you seen that?
I haven't seen it. No.
It is. You can find it on the internet. It's a short film. Presents a provocative and kaleidoscopic vision of the future, where I'm reading this. Physical and virtual realities merged, and the city is saturated with media. And you know, somebody has something like Google Glasses and more. And there's this lady in South America, and she's just going through her day trying to interface with all this stuff, and she's being bombarded by it. And everything around her is. That she sees is, in a way, it's supposedly sold to us as a higher relationship with life and the world around us. But in fact, it's just more advertising, just more layers of advertising that come at us in a whole nother way, with just a few helpful adjuncts. But you know, essentially, we're being sold something that is just a form of commerce as a great gift to us all the time. So people are beginning to be skeptical about it. They're just beginning to recoil now, I think, in a visceral level.
I want to try to stand that on its head, and I'm going to have Paul DiFilippo do the heavy lifting for me. So, I mean, another prism through which we could look at this whole question, or maybe another way we could use cyberpunk as a prism to look at a question, would be in the Apple encryption case, right? This is something that's, you know, dragged on, been an interesting public debate for about 12 months now, this whole question about whether Apple has to give up its encryption to the federal government in order for the federal government to help fight San Bernardino-style terrorists. This is important information for the government to have. So now we're kind of inverting what John was just talking about. Apple is almost potentially heroic in its stance, saying, no, you can't have that stuff. Or maybe Apple can never be heroic. But you could at least argue, Paul, that cyberpunk and the cyberpunk ethos at least gives people some kind of mental equipment to think about a case like that one. Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Maybe there's just two bad guys. That seems very much like a cyberpunk question.
Well, let me take a running start at this fascinating topic, to go back a little to you were talking about how we're living in a cyberpunk world, and perhaps we didn't, for some reason, all our warnings got ignored. I think the most famous case of a prophecy that actually defeated itself and prevented the thing from happening is still 1984, George Orwell's famous book. And many people will argue that the reason we never fell into a post-World War II scenario that resembled 1984 is because of that very book. It was such a powerful, dramatic warning that it forestalled the actual happening that it was intended to warn against. So that's a pretty high standard to measure cyberpunk against. And I don't think any piece of science fiction before or since has ever quite accomplished the same thing. But cyberpunk, in a way, was dealing with a much more seductive scenario. A lot of aspects, as I think John just mentioned, a lot of aspects of the cyberpunk world were actually pleasant and seductive and seemingly useful and something that we wanted to buy into. So currently, you know, every time something was offered, some new gimmick or piece of technology that we should have been a little leery of, we bought into it despite cyberpunk, or maybe even because of cyberpunk, because it did seem, you know, there were certain aspects of the future that seemed very gleaming and shiny and alluring. So I think, in a way, cyberpunk had a much more conflicted path ahead of it or role to play, because, you know, we didn't want, being science fiction writers, we were all technophiles and gadgetophiles to begin with, and a lot of this stuff did appeal to us, so we might have presented it in ways that were not, that were conflicted, that were not totally prohibitive and were somewhat alluring. So we do, the literature does hold some role to play in us, in the current landscape that we inhabit. You know, we made cyberspace look a little too alluring, and that explains why we're all hooked on social media these days.
All right, so Lee Grossman, you get the last word of this segment.
Yeah, I think social media really is an illustration of cyberpunk on both sides. On the one hand, it's something that very cynically exists just to sell advertising information, just to, like, you know, Facebook exists to harvest your information and sell it to advertisers in return for which you get social benefits. On the other hand, you have an awful lot of people who are, through social media and the social media that's tied into games and such, really tied to people online where they don't feel tied to anybody in person. Tied to people in cyberspace in a way that they don't necessarily feel connectedness in real life. And that's not a bad thing.
Obviously, we've, in all the ways that Elliot talks about, we've kind of voted with our own ideas and also with our own search for security. I mean, I mentioned the Apple encryption case. A lot of people actually think the government should just get all that stuff so they can protect us from terrorists. It's not unusual to see articles saying we need more cameras, we need them now, the case for surveillance. After the Boston bombing, there were articles like that saying, yeah, put up more cameras, keep us safe. So we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about television's most salient example of the cyberpunk mood right after this. Soft circuits jumping. The pin code to happiness. Access denied. Today's
show was produced by the McPants 4000, a transhuman microchip and flesh hybrid engineered to work in public broadcasting, and me, Kyone Wolf, a nanodevice that sits on the tip of your tongue. Greg Hill and Betsy Kaplan appeared in the intro, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Dolph Lundgren. Come find us on Twitter at WNPRColin and on Facebook at the Colin McEnroe Show page. On tomorrow's show, we revisit our conversation about raccoons. And now, back to Colin.
Well, I've saved the most important person for last. Alex Dubin is the guy who actually thought this show up and began guiding us towards the possibility of doing a show on cyberpunk. He's sitting in the producer's chair today, returning to us, having been an intern with us in the past. So Alex gets the big I guess you don't get a gold star in cyberpunk. You get like a degraded microchip or something. And whatever it is that you get, he gets that shiny little thing for having done this today. Thanks so much, Alex. Lee Grossman is in studio with me, teaches at the University of Connecticut, and is the author and editor of more than a dozen books, including Sense of Wonder, A Century of Science Fiction. Joining us now, we love Willa Paskin, one of our really favorite TV critics. She writes for Slate. She's written more than once about a show called Mr. Robot, which is wrapping up a season two right about now. Willa Paskin, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
For those people not lucky enough to have enjoyed Mr. Robot and all its blandishments, I know it's a hard show to sum up, but give us a thumbnail.
Mr. Robot is a show about a antisocial hacker who is trying to bring around the end of capitalism.
That was a good sum up. So, and then with that was better than easier than I thought it was going to be. So, in this, there are a lot of the elements of cyberpunk. I mean, do you consider this to be, in fact, an expression of the cyberpunk aesthetic?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think one of the reasons you thought, for example, that my answer about the show was going to be so much longer is it is extremely twisty. It has a lot of plot. There's a lot of detail in it. But I think maybe the best thing about the show is just its mood, which is extremely cyberpunk and, you know, sort of rebellious and eerie and menacing, and in a way that doesn't feel much like other television shows.
Let's see if we can get a little bit at that mood. We're going to play a clip. I don't think it needs too much explanation. I think it's from season one, episode one. So, Wolfie, that'll be clip C1. Let's let that roll.
Your real name's Rohit Mehta. You changed it to Ron when you bought your first Ron's coffee shop 6 years ago. Now you got 17 of them, with 8 more coming next quarter.
May I help you with something?
I like coming here. Because your Wi-Fi was fast. I mean, you're one of the few spots that has a fiber connection with gigabit speed. It's good. It's so good, it scratched that part of my mind, part that doesn't allow good to exist without condition. So I started intercepting all the traffic on your network. That's when I noticed something strange. That's when I decided to hack you. I know you run a website called Plato's Boys.
Pardon me?
You're using Tor networking to keep the servers anonymous. You made it really hard for anyone to see it. But I saw it. The onion routing protocol, it's not as anonymous as you think it is. Whoever's in control of the exit nodes is also in control of the traffic, which makes me the one in control.
So, Lee Grossman, you can draw a pretty straight line, or unbroken line anyway, from, say, Robin Hood to Philip Marlowe to Elliot here in Mr. Robot, at least in the sense that cyberpunk plays on a very old trope, the idea of somebody who's a little bit more moral than the immoral system around him, trying to right wrong, sometimes using borderline illegal or flat-out illegal methods, but essentially robbing from the rich, giving to the poor. In this case, it's more at the level of data.
Yeah, absolutely. Here, there's not much to rob or give, but he's at least doing the right thing when he can. He's forces bad relationships to end at times. I mean, things that are small, and there aren't big victories that are really attainable for him. For all that he's got this intent to bring down capitalism, it's not going to go well. You know, nothing is going to go well. The best he can hope for is to be out of pain for a while.
So, Willa Paskin, you've raised a really interesting question about Mr. Robot. I'm going to read your money quote about this. Because Mr. Robot does have this incredible anti-capitalism. Bring down the big corporations. They couldn't be more evil. They're so evil, they're called Evil Corp. Bring them down. Here's a quote from one of your pieces. Mr. Robot is like an iPhone with an I hate Apple ringtone. Both are beautifully designed, powerful products that are superficially conflicted about being beautifully designed, powerful products. For all that Mr. Robot invites us to think about global financial issues, the unchecked power of technology, and imminent societal collapse, it also demonstrates just how efficiently capitalism co-opts all critiques. It can even turn a criminal hacktivist into the poster boy for a cable network. So this is sort of your Theodore Razak point, Willa, that as subversive as cyberpunk might have seemed to be at times, it's still not something that can't be turned into a way to sell razor blades or whatever's coming up on the commercials.
You should see, if you watch Mr. Robot in real time, the commercials that air between Mr. Robot are often in Mr. Robot mode, like for security. Like other companies are selling like security devices for computers in the commercials for Mr. Robot. It's like, it's almost like you think they're fake commercials, but they're not. It's so trippy. Mr. Robot is an extremely successful television show. You know, it is a product. It's been really, really successful for USA. So as subversive as its message may or may not be, and I think in some ways it is really subversive and it really does have this sort of unique and furious tone, it's still making a company a ton of money.
So is there anywhere, Willa, to go from there, though? In other words, I mean, in a way, that's like the conclusion of a fairly bleak cyberpunk novel, that that some character thinks he's invented this incredibly subversive thing, and at the end, it's effectively being used. All of his force is being used in a kind of corporate jujitsu, where his strength is turned against him to bring about his own downfall. Is your view of it necessarily that negative, or is this at least a way for a couple of possibilities to be juggled in the air more or less at the same time?
Well, I mean, if you take that really bleak view, I mean, you have to think, I guess I don't take such a bleak view, because it's like, Mr. Robot is a television show. I think for a television show, it's actually accomplished a lot of really interesting things, and exploring sort of territory that other shows aren't exploring, and opening up all of these questions that we sort of don't talk about very often. Like, when was the last time you saw an anti-capitalist television show? I mean, even if it's not really, because it's furthering the interests of a major television network or a major corporation, it's still raising all these questions, you know? So I don't think it's like in terms of what it is, it's sort of radical. In terms of being radical, full stop, you know, it's not. But I think it's done more to sort of spark some conversation about these kind of questions that we just weren't having before.
I'm actually pitching HBO right now on a sequel to Curb Your Enthusiasm that actually stars Bernie Sanders instead of Larry David, and it will be an anti-capitalist television show. It'll be Curb Your Enthusiasm, but much more distrustful of the man. So Lee Grossman, this is, in some ways, it's at the heart of any kind of outsider genre, any outsider aesthetic, is the question of, you know, success means you're not so much on the outside anymore. How do you react to Willa's critique that, to a certain degree anyway, anything could be co-opted, even something like this?
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's been at the heart of cyberpunk forever. I think, you know, one of my favorite stories, Pat Cadigan's Pretty Boy Crossover, and she's, you know, wonderful cyberpunk writer who didn't come up in this conversation somehow. But, you know, where there's victory, it has a sort of a happy ending, but that's a temporary victory. We have no idea if the character is going to endure. He's able to resist this for the moment at the end of the story. He's able to make things better for one person, for one night, you know, and that's a victory of a sort. It's not, it isn't about destroying capitalism, and it is about making things better. And the things that create cyberpunk are capitalist things, and there's that paradox within it. It can't be totally anti-capitalist, but it is about the people at the bottom are using these tools in very different ways to fight back.
Willa, do you know yet whether there's a season 3 coming of Mr. Robot?
I don't think officially there's a season 3, but I would be extremely surprised if there were not a season 3.
I mean, it seems as though, just to go back to what we were saying earlier, like, just, you know, you watch the whole, I was saying to Lee during the break, you watch the whole Wells Fargo scenario unfold, where this company had this policy of getting its employees to gouge and grind and pressure and persuade people to get all these credit cards and other kinds of vehicles that they didn't necessarily want. And then the employees decided to go them one better and just simply issue the credit cards and all the other stuff without even asking consumers. To me, it's kind of like maybe Mr. Robot gives you the goggles, the cyber goggles, to look at something like that and understand it better. That, you know, maybe it's been co-opted, but it's also giving you, in some ways, a way to look at a story like that from real life and understand it from a different point of view.
Yeah, I think that that is true. I mean, I think that it's like you can critique something while still being of that thing. You know, you can have commercials on your show and still critique commercials as the show does. And that may undermine the purity of the critique, but that doesn't necessarily undermine the strength of it.
Yeah. So, Willa, I wear this device on my head that I got from Steve Mann that, first of all, allows me to get messages, see life more accurately. I can actually tell you there's a camera on you right now that I can see that you can't. But I'm also being told through it that USA has renewed Mr. Robot for a third season as of last month. It will end in 2017. I mean, they will air in 2017. Listen, thanks very much to Willa Paskin. We love her writing. Well, we have really enjoyed having Lee Grossman in the studio, and certainly our other guests, John Shirley and Paul DiFilippo, who are seminal writers in the world of cyberpunk. Great show by Alex Dubin, working with Jonathan McPants. We'll be back tomorrow with Raccoons.
The future is now.
Are you ready?
You know, I am continuously in awe of the technology we have here at WNPR. The microphones that we're using from 1984 sound brand new, and the point-and-shoot cameras our reporters use shoot 5 megapixels. And the software we use to trigger audio elements never fails.